This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ann Verbischer joins me live in studio. She is a planetary scientist, an astronomer, whatever you want to call him. She is at the University of Virginia and was part of the team that recently discovered a new ring around Saturn. And this is the largest ring. Hands down, right? I mean,
yes, it is.
This is huge.
Largest ring in the solar system.
Wow. Now, before we talk about this discovery and what it means and how you found it, give us an Ann Verbischer 101, where you're from and how you ended up being a scientist.
Well, I grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, and through a long circuitous route, ended up in graduate school studying planetary science at Cornell University in the mid-80s, and have pursued planetary science since then, mostly studying the satellites of Saturn. I did my PhD thesis studying the moons of Saturn, and I've not left that system very often.
Now, were you a kid who was always interested in planets and stars? I mean, did you have parents who were like, hey, let's look at the constellations?
I was really interested in the Apollo program when I was little. That just was everything to me. I wanted to be an astronaut. And when I was 5 years old, for my birthday, I got a telescope and a model Saturn V rocket. And I was an astronaut for Halloween, you know, the whole bit. So I grew up just fascinated with space and exploring, really. I think that was the most fascinating aspect of the Apollo program was being able to explore the moon. That just was really, really cool. And I wanted to be able to do that. And so I pursued a career that lets me do that vicariously through spacecraft exploration of other worlds in our solar system.
We're talking with Ann Verbischer of the University of Virginia's Department of Astronomy. The phone lines are always open at 977-1070. So tell us about this discovery. It's been international news over the last couple of weeks. And I'm sure you've done a bunch of interviews. Tell us how you found this thing. What made you want to look for it? Give us the whole story. And what is it? What are we talking about?
Yeah, we actually were looking for this ring. We've been asked that before. I think some people assumed that we just happened to find it, like it was a serendipitous discovery or something on that order. But no, we were actually trying to find or trying to detect this structure. And sure enough, it was a long shot to do this. You have to convince a telescope time allocation committee that it's worth taking the risk of giving you the observing time to do this, that
these telescopes,
it might just pay off.
These telescopes these days, they're like computers were in the 60s, right? You have to reserve time. Go in there, get in line, wait, and when it's your time, you got to be ready to go.
Right. I should explain that the way this was done was using the Spitzer Space Telescope. So this is one of NASA's great observatories out in space. So it wasn't a telescope down here on Earth that we used. It was one of those, and time on those telescopes is extremely hard to come by, and the process is pretty competitive to win a proposal, an observing proposal, to get time on that telescope to do this. So
how does it work? Where do you actually go to, quote unquote, look through this telescope that's sitting out in space?
You well, as part of your proposal, you especially with this telescope as opposed to Hubble, you submit the commands, so to say. You're the program that runs the telescope, and the commands that point it in the right direction, and that all goes along with your observing proposal. So it's all right there. They know exactly what you want to do, where you want to point it, and which instrument on the telescope you want to use.
Where is this thing controlled from?
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory runs Spitzer for NASA, and the Spitzer has its own center in Pasadena, California, that they operate the telescope through. So it's all pre-programmed.
Yeah.
You send up the commands to the spacecraft. They're loaded on board, and it performs the observations that it's instructed to.
So when was this window of time when you and your team were actually using this space telescope, the Spitzer?
Well, one of the stories that I could tell about this in the whole process was that we submitted our proposal almost 3 years ago now. It was a while ago, and you get two scores on your proposal that you submit. One's based on the scientific merit, and the other one based on the scheduling priority that they'll assign to something, whether the group evaluating this thinks that it's something that should be done right away or if it's something that can wait. And our proposal got rated as one of those that could wait. So,
oh, great.
it waited and waited and waited. This particular space telescope can only point at Saturn every 6 months. And in that window of time, it always has to keep one side, which has a large solar shield on it, blocking the telescope from the sun. Because this is an infrared instrument, and the idea is to keep it as cool as possible. So you don't want to have any part of the sun heating it up. So you really can only point it in Saturn's direction twice a year. And during that time, it's only like a 15 or 20 day window, something like that. So you don't have a lot of opportunities to do this. And we were watching those windows go by one by one. And since the telescope is so sensitive to heat, it also is the instrument we used on the telescope is cooled by liquid helium. And it wasn't launched with an infinite supply of liquid helium. That helium ran out, and we knew it would run out, but we were hoping our observation would be done before it ran out. It actually ran out of coolant in May, and our observations were done this February. So it was the last time that this telescope could look at Saturn at all.
So you got in there right before the nick of time.
Right, we did.
So the telescope can still be used, or is it?
It can still be used as a warm mission, but it's not as sensitive to it's not as useful for the observations that we did.
Yeah, Well, just in time. We're talking with Ann Verbischer of the University of Virginia. So in February of this year, when y'all finally got the opportunity to point that thing at Saturn, what did you see?
Well, we saw a bright band of light about where we would expect to see a bright band of light if it were generated by a ring or a dust torus around Saturn. And so our job then was to spend the next several months figuring out just what it was that we were seeing in those images. It was a long process.
Yeah. So you've identified then a new ring around Saturn. Explain this to us. Explain this first. What are the typical traditional rings around Saturn? And then what makes this this new discovery different or unique?
What's so unique about this ring is, first of all, its size. It's just absolutely huge. If you could see this in the sky, it would be the width of two full moons, one on either side of the planet as you're looking up in the sky looking at Saturn. That's how big it is. It's extremely faint and tenuous because, of course, when you don't look at the sky, when you do look at the sky, you don't see such a huge thing on either side of Saturn or spanning that entire width on either side of Saturn. The other thing that's odd about the ring is it's tilted with respect to the main rings, and that has to do with its source, where the ring comes from, and as far as the main rings, they're quite a bit different also in terms of their thickness. This ring is extremely thick. It's the width of 20 Saturns stacked on top of each other.
Wow.
So that's just huge as well. Whereas the main rings of Saturn are, for the most part, very, very thin. The ones we typically think of when you look through a telescope and you see the rings of Saturn.
And the main rings are more, the ones that are closer into Saturn, are more like rocks? And this one that you've discovered, you and your team, is more dust. Is that right?
They're probably both. Main rings would have a lot of ice particles, water ice particles in them. And this ring most likely does too. But we don't know a lot about its composition. We did have just this one observation, and it was done at the last possible time. So unfortunately, we can't go back with Spitzer and look at it some more. And I mean, the natural thing to do would be to map this thing out. We're saying it's as big as two full moons on either side of Saturn, but we really haven't measured that. We certainly know how thick it is. That we certainly saw in our data, and we have that nailed down. But
there, isn't there one of the moons that's in this new ring?
That's
and
what
we're
using.
What's the relationship between the...
That's what we're using to determine its width or how far it would span across the sky if you were able to look at it. That kind of goes back to the origin of this observing proposal in the first place. Is why were we even looking at this? And that all ties to the moon that generates the ring, which is called Phoebe. It's the largest of Saturn's outermost moons. It's about 200 kilometers in diameter. And this moon has always been a source of interest for planetary scientists because of its possible connection with one of Saturn's inner moons, which is called Iapetus. And Iapetus orbits much closer to Saturn than Phoebe does, but Iapetus has a really weird looking appearance. It's black on one side and white on the other. And astronomers have known it looked like that from its discovery. In fact, just yesterday was the 338th anniversary of the discovery of that moon, Iapetus, by the astronomer Giovanni Cassini himself in 1671 discovered Iapetus. So it's always had this odd appearance, and nobody could figure out why it looks so weird. And there had been ideas proposed that somehow dust from this outer moon called Phoebe, which also happens to be very, very dark, one of Saturn's darkest moons, gets onto that black side of Iapetus. So no one had ever made a direct connection between those two moons before. So that was part of our idea, was to pursue that a bit. The way this all got started was I had made some photometric observations using telescopes, a whole bunch of telescopes back in 2005, to observe Phoebe as well as the other Saturnian moons. And I was looking at the observations that I made. And what I saw was that in some of my data, especially the bluer pictures, Phoebe got unusually bright at a certain time, and even saw that it happening at pretty close to the same time from two different telescopes. So that was really strange. What was going on here? And I talked about this with Mike Skrutsky, one of the co-authors on this ring paper, and he immediately thought, well, we could possibly see some dust structure that would be causing such a brightness if that ever had occurred in the past. I should explain that seeing brightness like that on a momentary scale, the chances that I would be observing something unique like an impact on the satellite would be pretty small, not likely. But the moon, we do have high-resolution pictures of this moon, and it's got a highly cratered surface, just like our own moon. It's got craters all over the place. So it's obviously been hit many, many times over the age of the solar system.
So the rocks and the ice particles, we're talking with Anne Verbischer from the University of Virginia. The rocks, the ice particles, this stuff that's flying around in space constantly slams into planets and moons all the time, including our moon,
right,
and kicks up dust.
Right.
So is the theory that dust has been kicked up from this moon of Saturn to the extent that it's sort of orbiting Saturn now?
It's supplying this ring, and when particles hit this moon, when impacts do occur and dust and ice and all kinds of things get thrown up into the space around the moon, they start moving in the same direction that Phoebe's moving in and start going around Saturn with a orbital period of more than one Earth year, and they get thrown up there, and they probably are, they're still there. So that was the idea that we had was, well, it's not likely that I observed anything, unique, caught in a unique event or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea that such an event had not, or such events had gone on in the past is not crazy at all. And the signature of those events ought to be there. And then the Spitzer Space Telescope would be the perfect instrument to use to detect that dust. Because what we were looking for here and what we did see was the thermal emission from that dust, their heat radiation. So they're giving off heat just like we do. Our own bodies radiate heat in the thermal infrared. So these dust particles are warmer than the black space behind them. So the telescope is going to be able to see that.
So the telescope could see then like a ring of red far out from Saturn as this all this dust gives off a little bit of heat.
That's what it's picking up, the heat radiation from these particles. It's not the reflected light from the sun. That would be really faint and difficult to see.
Do they lose
this
heat?
This is the easy way to see this ring.
Do they lose that heat as they're traveling through space, or does the actual process of moving through space create heat?
No, they retain their heat. It doesn't create heat. They retain their heat.
Yeah. And I would assume that as things are continuing to hit Phoebe, it kicks up more dust, and this cloud, this ring cloud around Saturn of dust, is only going to get more dust in it.
Right. It could get, it's generally going to be continually supplied with
more material. How many moons does Saturn have?
I think the count now is up to 61.
Holy mackerel. You're kidding.
Yep. There are a lot of moons. 61
moons?
61 moons. Many of them orbit Saturn at about the distance that this ring does, pretty far from the planet. But Phoebe is by far the largest of those. Most of them are only like 10 or 20 kilometers at most in diameter, and Phoebe's 200. So
yeah. What's the largest moon of Saturn?
The largest moon of Saturn is Titan. That's
appropriately named.
Yes. An enormous moon with its own atmosphere. It's bigger than the planet Mercury. It's huge.
Wow. But it's not a separate planet because it is orbiting Saturn.
Right.
Yeah. Now, and that has some of these moons around Saturn, aren't there some of them that we believe might have water on them, or that have frozen seas or something?
Possibly below their surfaces. There quite possibly is liquid water on the moon Enceladus, which orbits Saturn quite a bit closer to the planet than Phoebe does.
We're talking with Anne Verbischer of the University of Virginia. She was part of the team that recently discovered a new ring around Saturn made of, the theory goes, dust particles kicked up by impacts on one of Saturn's moons, Phoebe. We're going to take a break for local news and weather, and when we get back, Anne, let's talk about your work as a member of the Cassini mission team. Cassini, of course, is the large spacecraft, and you were telling me before we went on the air, it's the size of a school bus.
Yep.
That is now, where is it now? Is it orbiting Saturn?
It's orbiting Saturn. Has been for 5 years now.
Yeah, and that is there specifically for us to help us learn more about Saturn and its moons as well, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Good deal. So we'll get an update on that when we get back in just a few minutes. This is Charlottesville right now. We're talking with Anne Verbischer of the University of Virginia, a research astronomer, planetary scientist, and she is part of the, she's a member of the Cassini mission team, which is what exactly?
Well, Cassini is a mission to Saturn and Titan, Saturn's largest moon. It's a mission that our country is participating in with NASA, and it's also an international mission. It's part of the European Space Agency and Italian Space Agency. So it's quite an international effort of scientists that have all contributed instruments on board this spacecraft, or this big robot that's the size of a school bus, that's been in orbit around Saturn for 5 years now, taking pictures and making all sorts of interesting measurements of Saturn's moons and rings and the planet and just everything.
Wow. So tell us again, give us a little Saturn 101 here. That's one of the gas planets, right? Like Jupiter. So if there's a glass of water big enough, it would float. There's no density to it, right? You can't land on it.
No, you can't land on it.
You'd fly right through it, right?
Right. It does have a density less than that of water. So yes, it would float in your bathtub if you had a bathtub big enough to put Saturn in.
Yeah. And those are the only two gas planets, or Saturn and Jupiter?
Uranus and Neptune. So we have four gas giant planets.
Interesting. So those four you cannot land on. They're balls of gas.
They're, like, for the most part, balls of gas. They probably do have solid cores somewhere down there, but
but not yet detected.
Nothing that we could land on.
Yeah. And you were telling me during the break, Saturn, of what, 61 moons around Saturn, that actually one of the moons is a gas moon. I never knew that. That's really interesting.
Well, Titan is the moon I was talking about. It has an atmosphere, but it also has a solid surface. So you definitely can land on Titan because I mentioned Cassini is a mission to Saturn and Titan, because on the side of this Cassini spacecraft, it carried a probe built by the European Space Agency called the Huygens probe, which landed on the surface of Titan on January 14th, 2005. So that was quite an event.
Yeah, I would imagine
Land this little spacecraft on.
But it's not like a rover on Mars. It didn't.
It didn't move anywhere. No, it kind of landed in. They said it more or less made a splat into the Titan mud, because on Titan temperatures are so cold that components like ethane are liquid there. So the ethane on Titan behaves like liquid does here on Earth. So there are lakes of liquid ethane on Titan, but the probe didn't land in one of the lakes. It landed on solid ground.
How big is Titan relative to the Earth?
Relative to the Earth.
Is it as big as the Earth? Or?
No, it's not as big as the Earth, but Titan's about 5,000 kilometers across. So
a small Earth.
Pretty big. And the radius of the Earth is 7,000 kilometers. So.
Oh, okay. I see. So just a little bit smaller.
A little bit smaller than, half the width of the Earth.
Of all the moons out there, Jupiter or Saturn has the most, right? The big gas planets have a ton of moons, right?
Right, right.
What is there one or two moons out there where we can sort of look at and say, wow, there really might be life there in the water there?
Definitely on the tiny moon Enceladus. If you're looking at that one, that's going to be closer to the rings than Titan is. You can see Enceladus in a telescope if you look at the right time.
Yeah. So tell us about what, and you mentioned Enceladus, the moon of Saturn. What is Cassini doing next week that's very, very exciting?
Cassini, the spacecraft, is going to make two flybys of Enceladus up in the next month. The first of these is on November 2nd. That'd be next Monday. And the next one after that is November 21st. Enceladus has been just a treasure trove of discoveries for the Cassini mission. It's just been incredible. The main discovery that Cassini has made is that this tiny little moon has fountains of water ice particles that are emanating from its south pole, or from large fractures that are observable on its south pole. And it's generating a dust ring like the Phoebe ring, but nowhere near as big. Now we know this.
Yeah.
That ring's called the E-ring. And so this huge plume that is coming out of the south pole of this moon has really got Cassini's scientists all excited. What's going to happen on November 2nd is the spacecraft itself is going to fly through this plume at an altitude of about 60 miles above the south pole of this moon. So it's going to fly just
very close where it's coming
right out. through these plumes. Right.
Is it in any danger? I mean,
no, it's not. They've determined that at that height, it's safe to fly the spacecraft through. What they are going to do, just to be sure, is maintain control of the spacecraft, because these plumes do exert a measurable torque on the spacecraft. So they could, in theory, make it tumble out of control. But not,
yeah.
I mean, not really. I'm exaggerating that. But just to be sure that attitude control is maintained throughout this flyby, Cassini's going to use its thrusters to do this flyby while it's going through
stay
the plumes.
Stay on course, yeah.
To stay on course, right. Normally, Cassini has reaction wheels, and that's how it orients itself. But the wheels are going to be turned off at this time, and it's going to be using its thrusters.
I find this so incredibly fascinating. So there's a moon around Saturn. How big is it?
It's about 300 miles in diameter.
So it's pretty small.
It is very, very small.
It's
that's
got
the
holes?
Amazing thing here.
Yeah.
Is this thing is so tiny, yet it's generating this incredibly huge ring, and the possibility that there is liquid water just under the surface is very, very real.
So this tiny little moon going around Saturn has holes in its south pole that are basically erupting water into space,
right?
That is then leaving a trail behind it,
right,
as it's going around Saturn. So you have this this ice ring then,
yep,
as this water, and it's continually coming out. It's like
the
red spot on Jupiter. This,
right.
It's constantly erupting water into space.
That's one of the major early clues that Enceladus was an active icy moon, because the theorists told us that this ring shouldn't really be there. Those tiny little particles should just, you know, float away, and it shouldn't even exist. But yet the fact that it does means that it must be actively generated, and it is. We now know that.
I mean, that water's repeatedly erupting from the South Pole on this moon.
Right.
So I guess the question is, what's powering it?
That's a question that Cassini scientists would like to answer. Relative to other spots on Enceladus, this is a very hot region. The temperatures there are quite warm, certainly warm enough to melt ice. And what's causing that heat is a question that we'd like to answer. It could possibly be related to tides, but don't really know for sure.
Yeah. Could the erupting of the water be related to the tides? Like you see water coming in at the beach and, you know, sort of going up through blowholes in the rocks and spewing water straight up in the air as the tide comes in?
In terms of generating the heat energy, possibly, they have looked to see if the plume activity does vary depending on where Enceladus is in its orbit around Saturn. If as it goes around the planet, does the plume activity get stronger or diminish in certain places? And they haven't been able to really nail that down yet. It hasn't quite worked. Other studies have made connections between, you mentioned the cracks or openings at the bottom of this moon that those ice particles are coming out of. Those do flex. They close and open just slightly, and depending on where Enceladus is in its orbit. And connections have been tried to be made between, are the plumes more obvious or active when they're open, and then do they kind of diminish a bit when they close up? And that really hasn't worked out too well yet either.
This is amazing. So what are you looking for when this happens next week? And the Cassini spacecraft flies through one of these water volcanoes, this thing on this moon spewing water into space. What are you looking for?
First and foremost, I'm looking for spacecraft safety and health. I want everything to go well, and that at the end of doing this, that we still have a healthy spacecraft in orbit around Saturn. That's the primary concern. Then it's going to be nice to get scientific measurements out of it. But
And Cassini will be able to detect what exactly? To confirm that this is indeed liquid water coming up out of this moon?
It's hard to say at this point if you're going to get any kind of confirmation. We're certainly going to be able to detect measure the composition of this plume better than we ever have before, because we're going to be closer than we ever have been before. Cassini has two sets of instruments. One of them is called the Orbital Remote Sensing Instrument, so that's what you can think of as being the eyes of Cassini, the telescopes and spectrometers and things you would point at a moon or the rings to measure its brightness or whatever. And then it has another set of instruments that are the fields and particles instruments. And they're mass spectrometers, things like that, dust counters.
It's sort of like the rovers on Mars. They can look, but they can also scrape stuff into its belly and analyze it.
Right. But these two groups of instruments are bolted to different sides of the spacecraft. So it's like you can either use one or the other, essentially, in terms of which ones are pointed optimally at what you want to observe. So for this flyby through the plumes on November 2nd, the fields and particles instruments are what's called prime, and that means that they get to control the pointing and control the way the spacecraft is oriented. So they're going to be set up perfectly to measure the composition of the plumes as they go through with the mass spectrometers and the dust counters and be able to figure out, you know, how big the particles are and what they're made of.
So we will know then what in the world is exactly coming out of this moon.
Right. We've already flown through it, and these instruments have made these measurements before, but not at this low altitude. We've been further away before in making those measurements. So we already know that the plume is mostly water ice, but it's got some other things in it, like carbon dioxide and some other organics, which are quite interesting.
It's constantly spewing water out of this moon around Saturn, it's erupting like volcanoes of water into space, that means that it's it's resupplying itself with water somehow. Is it? It must be raining, or does it just have this endless supply of ice that it's melting?
It is. There's continual fallout from this plume on the surface of Enceladus, and we definitely see that all over the moon. It looks like it snowed. I mean, some of the areas are covered with bright water ice, and
wow, that
very,
is amazing.
Tiny little particles.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, what long term? What's the life of Cassini, the spacecraft now exploring Saturn? How long does it go? I guess based on what's happened on Mars, it's hard to say what the life is of one of these robot explorers.
Right. Well, the Cassini. Maybe we should back up a bit. It was the spacecraft was launched in 1997, a long time ago. It took 7 years to get to Saturn and reached Saturn in July of 2004. So it's been orbiting Saturn ever since then. It had a four-year nominal mission, so that ended in 2008. And at the end of that, NASA proposed, or the project proposed to NASA, to extend that mission for two more years. So that's been approved, and Cassini's now flying on its extended mission, which is also called the Equinox mission, because Saturn went through its ring plane crossing this summer, where the rings were seen edge on. So the sun was shining directly on the rings, and you did not see the shadow of the rings on the planet at all. Now the Cassini project has proposed to NASA to extend the mission even further into what's called the Solstice mission, to take Saturn, take the observations all the way to the next Saturn solstice. So that would be summer in the southern hemisphere on, summer on the northern hemisphere on Saturn. And that won't happen until 2017. So they're proposing to extend this mission all the way till 2017, when the end of the mission will be what is proposed to put the spacecraft into Saturn. It will be crashed into the planet.
And we've never done that with anything yet, have we?
Yes, we have, actually. The Galileo spacecraft, which was orbiting the planet Jupiter for many years during the 1990s, was crashed into Jupiter at the end of its lifetime.
Did it just go right through it?
No, it didn't just go right through.
What happens to it?
Oh, well, gravity and radiation are so enormous on Jupiter that the spacecraft was just crushed by Jupiter's immense gravity not long after it entered the atmosphere. But the end of Cassini's life is going to be quite interesting, because the spacecraft is actually going to be put on polar orbits. So it's going to fly a number of orbits. I'm not quite sure how many there are, maybe a dozen or so, different orbits or different flybys close to Saturn, and so close to Saturn that it's going to fly between the main rings and the planet.
Which we've never done before.
We've never done that before.
Wow.
So for ring scientists, that's going to be really exciting to see what the rings look like.
Oh, the underside,
close.
Yeah.
Right, flying in these orbits around Saturn's pole between the main rings and the planet.
But that's because Saturn has no real density and it's a gas planet, Cassini will just, it's like going into a cloud, right?
Well, it'll be the same situation as the Galileo spacecraft flying into Jupiter. At some point, the gravity is just going to crush the spacecraft, and that's the end of the mission. So each one of these orbits takes it closer and closer to the planet until finally the last one, it goes in.
And Verbischer is a member of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Virginia. She's also a member of the Cassini mission team, which is the Cassini, of course, is the big spacecraft about the size of a bus, which is now orbiting Saturn and is going just next week. It's on Monday, right?
Monday is the flyby through the plumes. And then on the 21st, the as I mentioned before, the orbital remote sensing instruments are going to be prime, the cameras and spectrometers. So they're going to get to look at the South Pole of Enceladus and look at this fascinating region where these fountains of water ice are coming from. They're going to be able to get good close-up pictures on November 21st. Yeah. So,
and these things are erupting on that moon with enormous power because it's actually going way out into space.
Yep.
It's just mind-blowing. Yeah, I find that so fascinating. Just one of the many, many things, I guess, out there that's going on that we know so little about. And thank goodness there's people like you that fly these things. It's really fascinating. And thank you so much for being here. I've really enjoyed
it. Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Ann Verbischer is part of the team that recently discovered a new ring around Saturn. and she is with the University of Virginia and also a member of the Cassini mission team. Look for headlines about Cassini next week as it flies through a plume of water that's erupting off of Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.